Hello everyone, I am Jessica Saxton, the Environmental Education Outreach Leader for United Communities AmeriCorps and one of the hosts of Living Downstream. We acknowledge that the land upon which Umpqua Watersheds is located was formerly occupied and tended by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek, Umpqua, Coquille, Mulala, and others. Their history is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity towards the natural environment which indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement. Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives that different people have to offer, and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute.
Welcome. I have Chris Rush here with us today. She is with the Oregon State University Master Gardeners Program, and she is here to talk about the program. Thank you for joining us as the guest speaker for this episode. Would you like to introduce yourself and explain a little bit about what you do?
Yes, thank you for having me. My name is Chris Rush. I live here in Douglas County. I've lived here for over 50 years, and I worked for the Forest Service, but I'm now retired. So when I retired, I decided to join the Oregon Extension Master Gardener Program. And that was back in 2010. So I've been a Master Gardener for going on 13 years now. I'm currently involved with the Douglas County Master Gardener Chapter. There are like 19 chapters throughout the state of Oregon, and we are just one of them. We work out of the OSU Extension facility, which is located next to the courthouse here in Roseburg. We have a forestry help, small farms. We do a lot of forage and livestock assistance with our agents. And then within that group, there is also some school nutrition programs that come out of the extension office. As volunteers, our master gardeners give out education on sustainable horticulture. And that's what our mission is at the extension office. And the primary purpose of the entire state of Oregon Master Gardener program is to supplement and advocate for Oregon State University. That's who our sponsor is. And we enhance this program by volunteering to give community education, raise funds. We support community gardens throughout the state and educational school garden programs and do a lot of that kind of assistance on a advocate basis and also educational.
Thank you.
And then my main job for the Master Gardeners. I'm actually president of the state of Oregon Master Gardener Association. But in Douglas County here, I mostly am involved in our plant clinic.
And what is this plant clinic?
So the plant clinic is located in the extension office. And it's a opportunity. It's sort of like a hotline. It's an opportunity for anyone to call in. You can come in with your garden questions, or you can email us, and we are there. Right now, we're only open one day a week, but starting in February, we'll be open every day. And at that place, it's sort of like a hotline. You can call in with any garden or landscape question, and we have experts there that can assist you, help you get your garden questions answered. We use only scientifically based information from universities. So we don't really deal with hearsay or home remedies and that kind of stuff. It's all science-based. And we also offer a soil testing service for $10, $20 for the community. You can bring in a cup of soil to the extension office, and we can test it for all of the nutrients, the major nutrients that are important for your garden.
That's amazing. I did not know you guys had all those tools and services available. Do you also do water quality testing?
No, we don't do water quality testing. That is usually done privately in labs throughout the state. You can find them. I think there's a couple in Douglas County.
Got it.
We're mostly focused on agricultural practices. Yeah.
That's amazing. So can you provide a little bit of information about the Master Gardeners program impact throughout the state of Oregon?
Yeah, well, we, like I said, we do support, we have about 19 chapters throughout the state, and they're all based in different counties. And within that, we do a lot of training. We offer community outreach via educational programs, webinars, and that sort of thing. We have victory gardens in almost every county, which donate produce to local food banks. And I think over the course of this past year in Douglas County alone, we donated several thousand pounds of produce to UCAN. And this is currently being done, even in the metro area. The Master Gardeners have gardens where they donate to the local food banks up there. So that's the main focus. Like I said, education is our top priority, teaching people about sustainable garden practices. We have a big impact, thousands of hours. I think I don't have the statistics in front of me, but you can look at them online. If you just go to the extension.oregonstate.edu website, and there's a lot of information there for you to look up regarding statistics. But we have a huge impact. We have over 2,500 volunteers throughout the state that are doing this work.
That's amazing. That's a lot of people.
Yeah, it's a big volunteer organization for sure.
Wow. I didn't realize you guys had grown so big since the last time I looked at the website. So you mentioned trainings and educational opportunities. Does Douglas County have educational programs or events that people in the community could attend?
Yes, we have. So we offer our training to become a Master Gardener every fall. So we've just completed our fall series, and it's a 9 to 10 week course on gardening and gardening practices for new volunteers. And then in order to be a volunteer, you need to take that program as well as do 60 hours of volunteer community service. So, and we just completed that. But coming up March 11th, we're going to have what we call Spring into Gardening. And it's a one-day seminar that will be at the Phoenix School in Roseburg. It's on a Saturday. And at that seminar, we'll be offering 9 different classes to choose from on different gardening practices. Our keynote speaker for that event is our small farms agent, Logan Bennett, who is going to speak about the small farms in Douglas County and the impacts that they have on a lot of our small farmers. You know, do deliver food to the Umpqua Valley Farmers Market and sell in farmers markets throughout the county here. They are really important to Douglas County in terms of our agricultural impact. So he'll be giving the keynote speech in the morning, talking about all the small farms in Douglas County. Then throughout the day, there'll be educational sessions that'll be about an hour long that you can choose from to go to on soil, garden soils, on lilies, growing, the secrets of growing lilies, the secrets of growing irises, veggies, vegetables 101 is a class that we're offering. We have permaculture, a specialist that lives in this county will give a presentation on permaculture. There'll also be sessions on growing succulents. We have an expert succulent grower here in Douglas County, and she sells her succulent plants throughout the state. So she'll be teaching a class on how to propagate succulent plants and then use them in your home or outside or inside, because there's two different types. We have somebody to talk about bees and the importance of honeybees in our gardens and how to encourage pollinators. So yeah, there's just a huge wide variety of things. An expert on garlic, growing garlic and shallots and leeks will also be there. So I'm really looking forward to it. It's got something for everyone, a little bit of something for everyone to choose from a session. And it'll go from 9 o'clock in the morning till about 4 o'clock in the afternoon at the Phoenix School. So you can look for the registration. It's not available yet, but it will be available by the end of the month. And you can go to our Douglas County Extension website and register there. It's usually about $25 is all it costs.
That is amazing. That sounds like a lot of very interesting topics.
Yeah. Everybody will be able to find something they're interested in to sign up for.
Yeah,
that was our objective.
If I wanted to attend every single seminar throughout the day. Is that a possibility?
So there's, yes, you can have you can attend a seminar from after the keynote speaker from 9 till 10. After that, there'll be three sessions. So every hour will rotate and you can attend another session.
Okay, yep. Wonderful.
Yeah, looked really good. And we hope that the community, the Douglas County, the Roseburg community takes advantage of this offer, because it's a great way to meet other gardeners too, other gardeners that live in your neighborhood and exchange information.
Yeah, of course. Do you have other upcoming events? I saw that there is a Master Gardener Plant Clinic coming up soon. Do you have some information on that?
Yeah, so the Douglas County Plant Clinic is what I'm involved in. And that's just the hotline I was talking about. So this is a place where you can come. It's not actually a class. It's a place where you can come and bring your garden plant problems. We identify insects. We tell you how to take care of diseased plants. What we identify plants. If you don't know what you have growing in your yard, you can bring your plants into us and we can identify them for you. And that is a service that's available starting in February. It'll be available 5 days a week from 1 to 4. So that's just sort of a walk-in facility or a call-in. Or like I said, you can email us too.
Thank you.
Yeah, and then some of the other events that we have planned coming up is our plant sale, which is pretty popular in Douglas County. It's the first Saturday in May every year. We offer thousands of vegetable starts and perennial plants for your yard. We're starting to have some trees and shrubs available to sell. So that's at the Douglas County Fairgrounds. Look for that, the Plant Expo, it's called. And that's the first Saturday in May. There'll also be vendors there. That it's not just Master Gardeners selling our plants, but it's we'll have vendors there selling garden supplies and other garden-related things. And that is an event that's really pretty successful for us. It's our biggest fundraiser that we do every year for our organization. We also have a discovery garden that's located in River Forks Park that you can visit.
Yes, I recommend. Yes, it is beautiful.
Yes, you've been there. Yes. It is really beautiful. It doesn't look so good. It's a little drab this time of year because of the winter, but in February, it should be starting to bloom some everywhere. And then, so the Discovery Garden is located at River Forks Park, and it's an educational walkthrough garden. It's a demonstration of about 19 different types of gardens, from Japanese gardens to rock gardens. We have xeriscape gardens, and those are the types of gardens that require very little water or maintenance. We have rose garden, shade garden, sun gardens, children's gardens, all kinds of themes that you can read about as you walk through the garden. They're just little plots, but they are really lovely and educational at the same time. So you can do that. And then also out there, we have at River Forks Park, we have our Victory Garden, which is where we grow our vegetables that we donate to UCAN every week, once a week throughout the summer. We donate vegetables to UCAN.
That's amazing.
And that garden is called a Victory Garden after the theme from World War I, where a lot of people were growing Victory Gardens during the Depression and during that era. That's where we got the name from. With Victory Garden. So from that garden, we also can teach people about vegetable growing, and then also help at-need communities with their produce, fresh produce. It's good to be able to donate that.
Yeah, that is very true.
And then as you suggested too, we have the Umpqua Valley Farmers Market that we currently aren't at, but during the summer we staff that weekly. We have a person, couple people there, experts in the field of gardening. And there's a couple people there every week that will answer your garden questions right there at the Umpqua Valley Farmers Market on Saturday.
Thank you. Yeah, they were a huge help at answering my questions. And I have seen many other people out asking them as well. So that is a huge resource. So I am an avid gardener myself, but I mostly focus on like annual plants and vegetables. Do you have any suggestions on how, on which plants would be the best to survive the warm summers and cold winters here in Oregon?
That is definitely something that all of us are learning how to deal with, is those heat domes that we seem to be getting now every summer. The biggest thing you can do is to purchase some kind of shade material. And sometimes during those times of day when it's over 100 degrees, is to cover your plants. That seems to help. There's a product called Remay, REEMAY, that you can purchase at the DC Co-op and Coastal, some other locations throughout Douglas County here. And it's a great product. I think every gardener, especially during these times, should have it. And it also helps with frost. So at the end of the garden season, it's useful to throw over your plants or your vegetable plants to save them from those late frosts that we sometimes get in September and October. But generally, you can grow almost any vegetable in your garden. Carrots do quite well. Celery, I always grow celery. All the greens, lettuce and all the lettuces, spinach, kale, broccoli, cauliflower, better grown earlier in the spring than during the heat of the summer. So it's better to grow those, start those a little bit earlier. Tomatoes seem to love the heat, even if it's really hot. Although tomatoes sometimes they will shut down over, if it gets over about 95 degrees, they'll tend to kind of shut down and not produce so well. But nevertheless, they tend to like the hotter days. Peppers do really well here in Douglas County. You can grow almost any kind of sweet pepper or hot pepper in our area. We kind of like to call ourselves the banana belt. We're kind of a Mediterranean climate, and it's getting to where you would be surprised that I've talked to people. Just the other day, a fella came into the plant clinic who was growing oranges up in Sutherland. I was really surprised that he was growing them successfully. Apparently, he has them planted quite close to his house and covers them during the coldest parts of the winter. But nevertheless, he actually was growing oranges. It's an amazing area for growing vegetables, fruits, and berries, and all of those things.
Wow, that's incredible that he was able to grow oranges in this area.
Yeah.
So have you by chance noticed a change in the growing climate here in Oregon? I myself have noticed that some of my fruiting trees are fruiting a little bit later in the season than they did in prior years. Is that something you may have noticed?
Sure, for sure, that fruit trees and berry crops are all pretty dependent on climate, and the fruit trees, of course, will come out early if the springtime temperatures are high. And then if we have a cooler spring, like we did this last year in 2022, we had that a lot of wet weather in the spring and it was cooler. So some of the fruit trees didn't flower until later in the season. And that's probably why your fruit was also later. But that also affects, so weather definitely affects all kinds of things, budding, pollination. It affects the insect activity, the bee activity, pollinators. And so fruit trees are really dependent on weather conditions. That is for sure. But you can grow, fruit trees in Douglas County. There are pears and apples and cherries, peaches are all pretty popular. Pears grow almost without too much problem, except for they do get the coddling moth, but pears and apples both do. But all of those fruit trees and figs. Boy, I've seen some great fig trees in Roseburg area, and people just in people's backyards. And there's nothing like a fresh fig at the end of the summer day.
Yeah, that's very true.
But we have seen a longer growing season in Douglas County in the last like 10 years, probably. Extensions on both ends of the first frost date is a little bit earlier. And the last frost date, so that you can plant earlier now, and then extending into the fall, the frost dates are usually extended beyond. A lot of times, I think this year we didn't get a frost until mid-November or somewhere in there. So the growing season is definitely getting longer in throughout, I think, the Pacific Northwest. It's not just here in Douglas County.
And we will be back with this episode of Living Downstream real soon.
Umpqua Watersheds is hosting a snowshoe hike at Crater Lake National Park on Saturday, February 11th. The event is free, but please bring a sack lunch. This event is limited to 30 people. If you would like more information or to reserve your spot, please visit the events page at www.umpquawatersheds.org or by calling the Umpqua Watersheds office at 541-672-7065. And we are back with this episode of Living Downstream. Let's continue with Chris Rush from the Douglas County Master Gardeners Program.
Do you by chance know like what time of the year to bring your plants in or to cover them up? I've always struggled with knowing when the first frost was coming and preparing for it. How do you guys go about doing that?
I've been gardening for all my life, and I think I just watch the weather forecasts, and you can't always count on those for sure. But I keep a garden journal, and that's really helpful. So from year to year, I'll write down if I missed bringing something into the house out of the cold or those kinds of things. For sure, frost dates, I keep a journal of. We have a journal. My husband and I both are avid gardeners, and we have a journal for, we live in Tiller, so we're up in the mountains a little bit. So we have a little bit more cold weather, earlier frosts here for sure. And we just have kept a journal for the past 50 years of those kinds of things. So that helps. Another thing is to make sure that you read up on the plant that you have. You may have a plant that can withstand below 20 degrees, but another plant maybe can't go below 40 degrees. And that kind of information is really important to know when you have a plant in a container, particularly, so that you can put them in the garage during those cold snaps that we get.
That's good to know.
I have a pluot tree at home, and it seems to be about 2 years old.
It seems to have an infection. There's like this yellow jello coming out of it almost. Do you guys help with those kind of issues?
Yes, definitely. So what I would recommend that you do is take a picture of it, and you can bring it in. You can come into the plant clinic and show us. You can also, if it's on a twig or the fruit, you could clip the twig off and bring it in. Those kinds of things are best diagnosed through at least photographs and live samples. But pluots, that's not a plant that normally you would have found growing around here 10 years ago, but I think more and more it's a plant that people are capable of growing. I've heard of, it's pretty popular, I think, especially for urban settings, backyard trees and that kind of stuff. But it's probably some kind of fungus, and there are things you can do for that chemically, culturally, some organic remedies and non-organic, and we would help you decide whichever path you choose to take to treat your tree.
Wonderful. That's great to know. I acquired this tree a bit ago as a rescue project, and it has taken off, and now it has this infection, and I don't know what to do. So I hope to get some answers. So I will definitely be coming to you with my pictures. Yes.
Yeah. So I'll be there on Monday, January 22nd at from 1 to 4. Come and see me.
Wonderful. Yeah.
I would love that.
So on to our next question. Is there any decorative plants that work really well in the Oregon climate?
Decorative plants. Well, it depends on if you're talking about flowers or shrubs, or there's all kinds of plants that are beautiful. And I like, if you like small trees can be beautiful all throughout the year, like dogwood trees are really nice. They have flowers in the spring, they're nice foliage throughout the summer. And then in the wintertime, even their twigs are nice to look at. They tend to be a little bit red and really lovely. And they're a small tree that won't get over probably 20 feet tall. You can keep it pretty small. So dogwoods are beautiful, crab apples. I like those kind, any kind of flowering tree is really nice. I always like to encourage people to plant natives, especially nowadays with the changing climate, because if you go with the native tree, you're going to always have, we have the ability for that tree is going to be kind of adapted already to the climate here and those swings in heat and cold. And so I recommend things like red flowering currant is really a nice shrub, ocean spray, service berry, and some of those kinds of shrubs are easy to plant, easy to take care of. Oregon grape is our native flower, and Oregon grape makes a beautiful, the tall Oregon grape can make a beautiful hedge or specimen plant in your garden. It doesn't get very tall and requires very little water and care, even doesn't get any diseases that I know of. And it has a that beautiful yellow flower in the springtime. And then in the fall, it gets berries that you can pick. So, and then, you know, rhododendron is always a good one to grow for at least on the shady side of your house. We don't recommend that you put those in the sun, but rhododendrons are a native, beautiful native shrub that flower in the springtime and are evergreen, so that gives you some color throughout the year and even into the wintertime. So those are just some examples of some shrubs that are beautiful to look at.
Thank you. Do you have any recommendations? You had mentioned at River Forks that there was a small area that is low maintenance plot. Do you have any
Yes.
recommendations of plants that are low maintenance and require a little water?
Yeah, so that's called xeriscaping with the X. And it's sort of plants that require very little care, very little water. A lot of them are grasses, that ornamental type grasses that are out there. And there are some shrubs that are out there. There's a couple pine trees that require very little water, and pine, Mugo pine, which is sort of a shrubby looking pine tree that's nice. There's a lot of other plants that grow out there are mostly it's native grasses and the Douglas aster. It's a beautiful perennial flower that is purple, like a purple daisy, and it requires very little water. It's a good pollinator. The pollination, the bees love it, and so it's a good contribution for pollinating gardens. Goldenrods are native plants. So Douglas aster is a native plant, and goldenrods are native. They are excellent for pollinator gardens, and they also require very little water. And then kinnikinick is an interesting perennial that a ground cover. It's in the manzanita family, and it's a favorite in the Pacific Northwest. It's evergreen. It's got these little tiny leathery leaves and trailing format, and it gets little pink flowers in the springtime. It's just really lovely, and it will grow without any water as well. So those are just some of the ones that I kind of remember that are growing out there in our xeriscape area. And then of course there's also some mints. But some people like mints and some not so much because they can be kind of invasive if you don't take care of them. But some of the mints like Coyote Mint or some of the other ones are really decorative, very easy to grow, don't require a lot of water. You just have to be careful that they don't take over because sometimes they can be a little bit invasive. I would just recommend that people go out there to the and visit that area. And like I said earlier, the Oregon grape is a really good one that is also located in that xeriscape garden.
Thank you. Do you guys have information about each plant species on your website?
We don't on the website, no, but there are publications. So if you go to that website I mentioned earlier, what was it called? The Oregon State. Extension.oregonstate.edu website. There's publications there. On the right-hand side of the website, there's all kinds of publications that are put out by Oregon State University. And there are some plant lists there that show deer resistant plants, and then they have shade tolerant plants and plants that require full sun, full shade, and those kinds of things. So yeah, I guess you can find those if you scroll through the publications on that website.
Perfect.
And that's pretty useful information there on that.
Yes. Yeah. I myself use the Oregon State Extension for all of their plant information. It is very helpful.
Yes. I always recommend that just because it's, you know, that it's correct information that you're getting there. And that's really a big part of it, because sometimes when you can buy a plant that in the store that really isn't adapted to our climate here or our soils either, for some, and yet they're sold sometimes in nurseries and especially box stores. So you have to be careful about that. Knowing what you have a place to plant and know what you want before you purchase plants. That's what I always recommend.
That's a very, very good tip. I agree with that. So if someone was interested in volunteering with the Master Gardener program or becoming a volunteer Master Gardener, how would they go about getting in contact with you?
That's a good question. So like I mentioned earlier, we have every fall, we have a class, and we just completed our last session for volunteers. So look for our next session will be probably starting sometime in September 2023. And you can get on, we do have a waiting list. It's a pretty popular class. And so there is a waiting list, but I recommend that people stop by the extension office and sign up sometime in the summer, early summer, for that, to get on the list for that class. And there is an interview process, just because we want people to understand the expectations that we have of our volunteers, that they do volunteer. It's not just a gardening class. It's actually training people to train others in gardening, as well as volunteer work. So there is that expectation, and we like to make sure that people know that.
Thank you.
And yeah, so that's in the fall. Okay. And you can't volunteer, well, you can't really volunteer in our gardens or at the plant clinic unless you're a master gardener.
Okay. I was just going to ask about that. I was wondering.
Yeah.
Okay. And what about children? Are they able to, is there any activities or volunteer opportunities for them?
Yes, unfortunately, so our program at Extension for children is the 4-H, of course, very popular, and that is through Extension. So I would recommend people who want their kids to get involved in agriculture, farming, they have all sorts of activities, as well as gardening. I would recommend looking into the 4-H program for kids.
Okay. That's a good
suggestion. We don't have a children's Master Gardener program, although some counties do have a Master Gardener, they call it the Junior Master Gardener program, but in Douglas County, we don't offer that.
Thank you. Do you have any information you would like to provide to our listeners?
Well, I just want to remind everybody about the services that we offer at the Extension. So it's not just for gardening. We also, like I mentioned, we have a forester there to help you with your woodland operations and livestock and pasture specialist who will help you with animals, and then a small farms agent who can assist you in any kinds of questions about small farms, startups, and that kind of thing. So we have a plethora of specialized people there to assist you, and it's all free. We don't charge. We do charge for that soil test, like $20, but and some of our classes are we do charge for some of our classes, but they're minimal cost because we understand that some people can't afford to spend a lot for their classes. So we have a little bit of something for everyone at Extension. And I would just encourage people also to stop by the plant clinic and just come visit us and check out what we can do for you. because that's what we are there for, is to help you in your pursuit of successful gardening. We want everybody to be successful in their gardens. And like I told you about your pluot tree, make sure that you take a picture. You can email us. I'll give you our email is douglasmg@oregonstate.edu. That's douglasmg@oregonstate.edu, all lowercase. And you can just email us and you don't even have to come in. You can email us and we'll answer your questions as soon as we can get to them. And then like I said, in summary too, I'd encourage people to go out to River Forks Park and check out our Discovery Garden. Our children's garden out there is really, really lovely. And all of the people work really hard. That's all maintained by volunteers, not by park people. So we have that all maintained by volunteers. It's open from dawn till dusk every single day. And it's a self-guided tour. So you can go out anytime and just read the signs as you walk through it. I encourage people, especially if you're thinking of working on your landscape or changing some things in your landscape, I love to encourage people to go out there and look at that before you decide what to plant and what you want to do. And all of our plants are also labeled so that you can take a notebook with you and write down the names of the plants and some of their requirements that are needed for them to grow successfully.
Thank you. I did not know that the volunteers managed the garden there. I want to thank all of you for keeping it so beautiful. Yeah, that's amazing out there.
Yes, thank you. I just want to encourage people to come into the plant clinic, and I'm looking forward to meeting your pluot tree.
Yeah, I encourage everyone to visit as well. And I want to thank you for being on this episode of Living Downstream. And if you guys have any questions, please make sure you reach out to the Master Gardeners here in Douglas County.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Living Downstream. And now, a special segment brought to you by Green Teacher.
This is Talking with Green Teachers, a show where environmental educators discuss recent developments, big ideas, and creative approaches to teaching green. In this episode,
some students come into these programs with a really positive association with the outdoors and are ready to jump right in and will happily skip down the trail. And there are many students for whom this is a really new experience and may not feel safe. It may even, provoke trauma.
A gentle gust of wind enlivens the canopy as a child approaches the base of a towering sequoia in Mariposa Grove, the largest of three well-known clusters of these ancient giants in Yosemite National Park. How was this once a seed? It's almost silly. This is day 3 of 5 on this overnight science program with NatureBridge, a residential environmental learning center that has operated since 1971. RELCs like NatureBridge allow students to explore green spaces while igniting their social and emotional learning. Recently, educators at RELCs were gifted with a new comprehensive tool for nurturing students' social and emotional learning, the aptly named Grow Outside Project. Here is Estrella Reisinger of the California Association for Environmental and Outdoor Education on the development of Grow Outside.
Grow Outside was born out of NatureBridge's involvement in the SD Bechtel Jr. Foundation's Character Initiative, which aims to strengthen evaluation and continuous improvement systems within influential youth development organizations. At NatureBridge, which is a residential environmental learning center, or RELC, where student groups spend multiple days living and learning together about the natural world, we focused on better understanding and then implementing best practices in social and emotional learning, or SEL. And I think it's important to note that while there exist several leading frameworks and theories related to youth's development of the skills and attitudes necessary for success in school, work, and life, SEL is a term that has gained popularity and use in recent years, particularly in formal education. And so that's where we put our emphasis. We really saw this as an opportunity to strengthen our practice and to articulate the unique value of our field to the growing body of research on positive youth development.
The child walks forward, stepping on a small round lump, a sequoia cone. We're not supposed to take anything from a national park, but what's the harm on keeping it for 2 nights?
How then did this expand to include other organizations?
After a deep dive into our own organization, in the fall of 2018, NatureBridge convened a working group of 10 other RELC organizations, along with our partners at the Beatles Project out of the Lawrence Hall of Science at UC Berkeley. Our collaborative spent a year working through the question of how to most effectively incorporate SEL frameworks, research, and preferred practices into residential environmental education programming. And the result of that partnership is Grow Outside, which is grow-outside.org. We believe that for the field of residential environmental ed to remain relevant, it's essential that we develop an understanding of SEL, strive to incorporate research-based best practices, and articulate our unique value and contribution to the growing awareness of how best to support young people's development.
People often talk these days about getting caught down internet rabbit holes, and I found myself going down several rabbit holes on your website, all of them very meaningful, I should add. And there are just so many tools. You've got the reflection tool, links to studies like the one that the Beatles Project was involved with about equity and inclusion in the workplace. With regards to equity and inclusion specifically, during the process of all of this coming together, were there any priorities that naturally rose to the surface?
Taking the context around you into account is essential. And in the context of culture, of thinking about what's happening in your community, even more so thinking about what's happening, you know, in your organization itself. And that's why if you look at the way we've laid out these resources, we wanted to ensure that there were resources that spoke to what happens in the field, certainly, because that is incredibly important and influential, but also what can happen at the organizational level. And one of the primary resources on the site is the reflection tool. And it is a beast. It's a long document, but we really see it as one of the kind of cornerstone materials that resulted through this project, because it takes all of these elements chapter by chapter, right? So thinking about the organizational context, thinking about what's happening in the residential setting where students are living and learning together overnight, thinking about what happens between a student and an educator out in the field, thinking about how the organization is engaging its stakeholders and involving them in decision-making. All of these components are laid out step by step with reflective questions and prompts to help you as an organizational leader really look at your current practice. You know, we created this resource with some support from the Beatles Project, from their staff, and much of it was built off that design that you see that is one of the recommendations coming out of that equitable study that they did, which is a capacity building tool to specifically focus on the role of cultural relevancy and equity in your program setting.
Let's get into that cultural relevance piece. And how does that manifest in a very practical, on the ground level?
Yeah, I mean, I think it looks different in different program sites, you know, as it should. I think that, one of the criticisms that has come out about social and emotional learning is that it's been this sort of off the shelf, one size fits all approach. And we know that in reality, that's not the case. And, you know, it's, I think, similar to any quality science instruction. It needs to be differentiated. There needs to be adaptability, opportunities for teachable moments, and really the deep learning that can happen is when students are most engaged and are helping to generate content and contribute to their own learning. With social and emotional learning, similarly, you know, we see the need for, educators to have the skills so that they can tailor their instruction, tailor their approach, so that it really meets the students where they're at. And in terms of the cultural relevancy component, you know, there are so many different ways that educators can meet the needs of their students and support them in their program. Understanding where they're coming from and what their experiences have been in the outdoors. You know, some students come into these programs with a really positive association with the outdoors and are ready to jump right in and will happily skip down the trail. And there are many students for whom this is a really new experience and may not feel safe. It may even provoke trauma. And so providing the educator with training and tools to support young people, no matter what their experience in the outdoors has been, to make that be a safe that feels safe, where they feel included, where their full self, is reflected in the curriculum, in, the educators themselves. So that's looking at, for example, the hiring processes. We have a lot of work to do as a field and a great necessity to look critically at who has had access to an environmental education, who is being called to do the work, and who we're hiring, and looking at our recruitment strategies, looking at our networks, and really thinking about how we can better serve our young people so that they feel reflected in their teachers as well as in the curriculum. One thing I do want to be clear, this resource, the growoutside.org, we see tremendous overlap between social and emotional learning and equity and inclusion work. Obviously, I personally believe you can't really approach social and emotional learning without attending to equity and inclusion, at least not well. And throughout the resource, you'll see a number of places where we do make reference and kind of think about whether it's a call out or, a call in, kind of thinking about how a question might be worded in a certain way, or, what might you want to be thinking about in your hiring. For example, yet none of us have that as our primary background and our primary lens, so we are not making a claim that this is a resource focused solely on equity and inclusion. And in fact, we point to a number of other leaders in the field, like the Center for Diversity in the Environment, Youth Outside, Avarna Group. There are some really spectacular organizations who are doing great work in this crossover of equity and inclusion and nature-based programming. And we do our best to kind of showcase them and highlight their work and direct people towards those organizations for direct support themselves, while also, attempting to help to illustrate some of that overlap.
It's time for a short break. We'll be right back. The child doesn't even look at the cone over the final 2 days. Just knowing it's there in the side pouch of their backpack is enough. A small bulge representing so much. Potential, change, hope.
I know a big part of this discussion is just the overall historical context of environmental education. Can you sort of unpack that aspect? Because I think that's a really important thing to establish, and it might not necessarily be top of mind for many people just because it's been set in stone for so long.
Yeah, I mean, for those of us who are well-versed and kind of familiar with this field, if you ask your average environmental educator, like, what does an environmental educator look like? Or what is environmental education? Right. Unfortunately, a lot of us might imagine someone young, white, fit, able-bodied, resources. They are probably well-educated. And there are many educators out there that fit that description who are exceptional and, well-deserving of being in the field. And there are countless others who are doing this good work, but perhaps may not consider themselves, environmental educators or haven't been welcomed. And certainly even, far greater numbers of folks who could be terrific working in the field, working with young people, but who haven't felt included in this space. And if you look at the leadership across our organizations, we know that this is a predominantly white field, and we have a lot of work to do. And I think it's really interesting, some of the work that came out of the Green 2.0 project, looking at more conservation side of environmental organizations. We know that the educational system has had a number of exclusionary practices as well that have historically pushed out educators of color. And so here we are at this kind of crossroads, right, between the environmental movement and the educational movement, and combined in environmental education, we see kind of vestiges of both, and some of the challenges. It feels like at this moment there is this real reckoning and tremendous opportunity, and you do see a lot more positive outreach efforts. You see just in the last year, a number of organizations that are led by and for people of color in the outdoors, and really a push to, you know, have organizations look critically at their hiring practices, at their organizational structures, at their leadership team, really at all levels of the organization, to be thinking about how do we best lift up young people. If that is our goal, you know, we can't be blind to the way our organizations are set up. And there, it feels like there's some really positive momentum now, but we are, you know, we're talking about decades of practices where we have not been fully, inclusive or equitable as a field.
What are some of, you could call them invisible barriers, that even people with the best intentions who are trying to create an open and equitable environment, what are some of those invisible barriers that they may be missing?
Are hiring practices and recruitment practices, are they truly equitable? And looking at promotion practices in particular, you know, who is getting those opportunities to step up in the organizations? Who are being mentored? Who are being trained? Is that being approached in an equitable way as well? You know, another piece I think is just the environmental education itself. You know, I think that we've really done ourselves a disservice in some of the images that we've used. And I, you know, I want to point to the outdoor recreation industry as well, who, similarly is going through a real kind of reckoning period right now with being called to look at who is wearing their gear, you know, what kinds of bodies are we seeing in these advertisements? And, you know, I think that we've certainly have, perhaps not intentionally, but we are experiencing now the fallout of the impact of holding up kind of this ideal of what environmental education is and who it's for. And, you know, I think that, you know, we have to also look at the instruction itself, you know, and thinking about what I mentioned earlier about the experience of many young people and people of color, you know, having historical trauma associated with being in the outdoors and us not really talking about that or even being aware of it. By us, I'm referring to, you know, white educators and trainers. And so really needing to think about our teaching practices as well, and kind of recognizing that we have a lot of great work to do to improve our practices, for those of us who are, you know, current practitioners. So I talk about recruitment and hiring and, you know, all of those opportunities. And absolutely, yes, they are important. But for those who are working in the field now, what can we do to make the experience better for our students? And that's what the Grow Outside resource is really all about, is trying to help us to look reflectively at our practice, to try and encourage our organizations to find opportunities for growth. In the same way that we want our students to look carefully, develop self-awareness, find opportunities, right, for ways that they can be a better citizen, you know, really show up. How do they want to show up in the world? Something that we talk about a lot. And I think that our organizations need to do that hard work too.
The final morning has arrived. Reluctantly, the child removes the cone from their backpack, hesitating slightly about whether to keep it or let it go.
Looking ahead, what does progress look like?
I gotta say, it's hard to imagine exactly what progress or success would look like several years from now, when in reality, we're just focusing on our day-to-day and trying to survive. As a field, we have been impacted tremendously by COVID-19, and a number of the organizations, and many of those even who are a part of our collaborative, have been in a situation where they've been required to shut their doors, if not go on hibernation. Luckily, you know, there has been great creativity in our field, and we're seeing organizations and educators develop all sorts of unique approaches to connecting young people with the natural world, even through these challenging times, you know, offering online programs, collaborating with in-school teachers, having physically distanced programs, you know, where that's feasible. Perhaps most remarkably, you know, I think given this particular moment in history, there is this really just amazing optimism around what we hope our field might look like when we are able to emerge. And center to that hope is equity. And the conversations that I've been having with a number of other program leaders about what it will look like to return to programming, I don't hear anyone talking about returning to programming as usual, that this really is an opportunity for deep introspection and for improvement. And I think that's great. You know, as difficult as this moment has been, and you know, there is a lot of uncertainty about what the future will look like for environmental education, and in particular for residential environmental education, which, you know, seems to have been hit amongst the hardest. You know, there's great hope as well. And I see organizations using this time to conduct a real serious pause, to look at their hiring practices, to consider how their programming might become more culturally relevant, to think about how to distribute, you know, the impact on staff so that it's not just felt by frontline educators, and in particular, staff of color. That is something that we are really concerned about.
And it's a concern that's now top of mind in so many discussions. And as you say, going back to as usual isn't really on the table. People want to do better. And there seems to be very real hope that we will do better. What else is giving you hope these days? What has you excited?
One thing that I'm personally really excited about is that I now wear another hat. I'm the executive director at AEOE, which is California's Association for Environmental and Outdoor Education. And we are launching a certification program for environmental educators. It's been something that's been in the works for many years. And, you know, we thought a lot about whether this was the right time to take this big step forward. But the feeling was that now more than ever, we want to be able to come together in community and really focus on creating the type of world that we want. And to do so, to think about how to strengthen the practice of current practicing environmental educators. And social and emotional learning is at the core of that program. We're really thinking about how to develop relationships, the network building that is possible, the type of reflective practice that is a core to what you see at growoutside.org, and really ensuring that social and emotional learning is built into the design of the program as well as the content itself, that in order to be an environmental educator, you have to have an awareness of what's happening in youth development. And in particular, a need to focus on equity and inclusion. And I'm really delighted just to see the applications coming in and the enthusiasm that educators are expressing across the state for having an opportunity to continue to advance their learning and to advance the field collectively.
Final thoughts about the direction we're headed?
It's hard to imagine exactly what what this world will look like 2, 3, 5 years from now. My hope is that we are moving towards a society where every young person has the opportunity to experience meaningful learning experiences outdoors, where they feel themselves reflected in their educators, where they feel heard, where they feel valued, and where being in nature is something that is second nature, you know, to each one of us, that it's built into our very school systems. Will we get there in 2 or 3 years? Unlikely, but given the current conversations around outdoor learning and the increased need for and value of having experiences in nature that we're seeing all across the country, I'm certainly hopeful that we'll get there.
There wasn't enough time to take the sequoia cone all the way back from whence it came, but the child left it on their bed, confident that one of the Nature Bridge staff would find it and take it back to Mariposa Grove, where it would once again rest in the shade of its parent. A small bundle of potential, ready to sprout new life. Talking with Green Teachers is co-hosted by Ian Shanahan and me, Sofia Vargas-Nessi. I also voice most of the ads. Ian serves as the show's writer and editor. Logo design and additional voiced ads are by Devin Therrien. Look for our monthly episodes on greenteacher.com. For access to all episodes, subscribe to Green Teacher and also receive our quarterly magazine, as well as exclusive access to our vast archive of webinars and magazine back issues. Thank you for joining us on this episode. We'll chat again soon!